Joshua 13 through 17. Part of this section reads a little bit like Judges. We'll look at that in a little bit. Five chapters. That's the plan for today. We are not going to read through all of that. I'm trusting that you have read through it on your own already. Joshua 13 through 17. By the way, if you are at a point where you don't have access to a study guide because you got misplaced or lost the email, just text me, email me. I'm happy to send that out again. And I do have the other copies yet to be made for the rest of your book because of just like lesson 8. I have 9 through the end, but I just haven't printed yet. So that's coming soon. Let's go ahead and pray together, and then we'll look at Joshua 13. Father, thank you for this time that we can open your word and be impressed with your plan and see the lessons that we need to learn. Help us to be a people devoted to you and a people who are courageous, people who fear you more than anything. Thank you for being our God and for being our Savior, and thank you for the promises that we look forward to in Jesus, the hope that's stored up for us in heaven, that one day we'll get to enter into our rest. Please be with our conversations and help it to be pleasing to you and encouragement to each other. In the name of Jesus we pray. Amen. All right, so Joshua 13, can I get a volunteer to read 1 through 7, please?
Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years, and there remains yet very much land to possess. This is the land that yet remains, all the regions of the Philistines and all those of the Geshurites, from the Shihor, which is east of Egypt, northward to the boundary of Ekron. It is counted as Canaanite. There are 5 rulers of the Philistines, those of Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, and those of the Abim. In the south, all the land of the Canaanites and Merah that belongs to the Sidonians, to Aphek, to the boundary of the Amorites, and the land of the Gebelites, and all Lebanon, toward the sunrise, from Baal Gad below Mount Hermon to Lebo Hamath. All the inhabitants of the hill country, from Lebanon to Misrephoth Maim, even all the Sidonians. I myself will drive them out from before the people of Israel. Only allot the land to Israel for an inheritance, as I have commanded you. Now therefore divide this land for an inheritance to the 9 tribes and half the tribe of Manasseh."
Okay. Now earlier, in chapter 11, in verse 23, Joshua took the whole land. And so the idea in summary is that they've conquered a lot of the major outposts, a lot of the major cities. But there's still a lot of Canaanites left to be dispossessed. And so enough has been conquered. Now it's time to divide it up and take it. So 11:23, Joshua took the whole land, as the Lord had spoken through Moses. And then, my iPad wants to finally have me join the internet. So what's he getting at here with the Lord driving them out from before the people? What's going on here? Who's going to do the fighting? God's going to do the fighting. And? Israel's going to have to do the fighting. So this is not a God saying, all right, you just walk in and I'm going to blow them out. But you're going to have to do some fighting here. So this is a relationship where they're all going to be working together. God's going to be doing it, but they have to participate. So I will drive them out, but you must be courageous. You must go in as I've commanded you. So go and divide the land, take it out. Verses 2 through 3 is a reminder that the Philistines are there. Now, what's interesting to me about this, have we seen the Philistines before in the Bible? Where have we seen the Philistines before? If you've read the Bible, you've seen the Philistines before. In the Bible narrative, chronologically, have we come across the Philistines? You're right. They are the kind of the big bad guys with David and Saul, right? With Saul, he's having trouble with the Philistines. David fights against, who's the big Philistine against?
Goliath.
So before that, though, before this, where do we see the Philistines? They're not the giants. There have some giants among them. When they're leaving Exodus, when they're leaving Egypt, when their Exodus is seen from Egypt, God says, I could take them this way, by way of the sea. But I'm not going to, because if I take them that way, they'll meet the Philistines and they'll meet war.
They're also in Genesis 21.
So in Genesis 21, you've got who is ruling over the Philistines? Abimelech of Gerar, right? So you've got some interaction already between Abraham and Isaac and the Philistines. And then you've got God saying, I don't want to take them this way through the land of the Philistines, the country of the Philistines, lest they see war and get discouraged. So they've kind of been on the horizon for a while. There's been some interaction with God's people already. Did I miss something? Yeah, okay. All right. But now it's time to go in, and there are going to be some of the combatants they're going to have to face. So they're going to have to face up against the Philistines. You have the five major cities. Try to memorize those if you can. They're going to show up later in 1 Samuel. You've got Ekron, Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gath. Gath, of course, is the one that's famous for Goliath, right? Goliath of Gath. But God says, I'm going to go in and I'm going to take care of these people for you. So kind of marks out some of the major boundaries here. And then he starts talking about the tribes are going to be on the east side of the Jordan River. And who are those tribes? Mm-hmm. Jordan, yeah. Three tribes on the east side of the Jordan. You raise your hand. Yep, okay, what's one of them?
Is it up there?
It is up there. Let's talk a little geography here. What's this big blue thing on the left? That's the sea, right? Which sea is it? Mediterranean. Now, the Bible will often not call it the Mediterranean. It will call it the Great Sea, because Mediterranean, let's get real primitive here. Med means
middle
and terrain,
ground,
earth, right? So terra, it's the sea in the middle of the earth. Okay, so from their perspective, this is the Great Sea. Okay, Mediterranean. This big blue thing over here that looks like a manatee on its side, that's the Dead Sea. Okay, it doesn't look like that anymore, by the way. Google it sometimes on Google Earth. It is much, 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 much smaller for lots of reasons. This whole area is called the Levant. Okay, it's called different things. It's called Palestine. That'll get you in trouble today. That's from Roman times. You can call it Canaan. You can call it Israel. That'll also get you in trouble depending on who you're talking to. The general term is the Levant. Okay, now we'll talk about the breakdown of the land in a little bit, but we'll talk about Judah and their territory, but the three tribes that are on the east side. So the Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea from what sea? The Sea of Galilee. Now, what's another name for the Sea of Galilee? Lake Tiberias. What's another name for Lake Tiberias? Gennesaret. What's another name for Gennesaret? Chinneroth. Like, there are lots and lots of names for this sea. The Sea of Galilee is the lowest freshwater sea on the planet. The Dead Sea is the lowest point on land, if you consider the Dead Sea on land, the lowest point on land on the planet. So this whole area is very, very low in elevation. So from the Sea of Galilee, and there's a lake just north of the Sea of Galilee, but the Sea of Galilee, you've got the Jordan Rift Valley, and it flows with the Jordan River down into the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea, if it's the lowest point on the earth, then what river flows out of the Dead Sea? No river flows out of the Dead Sea, because if it did, it'd have another lowest point on the earth. Okay, so everything flows into the Dead Sea, nothing flows out. And, of course, it's called the Dead Sea because...
salty, nothing can live.
All right, so we got some basic facts. So if you kind of look, you see Jericho on the map here? In fact, I wish I had a little pointer here. I'm not going to jump, but you see Jericho, there's a little river in there. In fact, you've got a map in your study notes. But Jordan River is here, and then Reuben, and Gad are on the eastern side of the Jordan River. What's the other tribe? Does it have a point, like a laser?
Yeah.
How does it work? Oh, this button. Oh, but it's not going to show up.
Oh,
it was a good idea, though.
All right, you'll just have to use your brains and your eyes.
I'm going to be offensive here. Reuben, Gad, and half a tribe of Manasseh. Okay, got it, Jordan? Reuben, Gad, and
Manasseh half.
That's the one. Okay, now, as you get into chapter 13, verse 8, he starts to divide up these territories. Now, I was reading this this last week, and it just, it struck me. We'll talk about some of these places that they're significant as you go through the Bible stories. One of the things about places, do you have a song that when you hear it, it just sort of kind of takes you back? Okay, and it's like it reminds you of a particular event, particular place, even a particular person, where there's a scent, and you smell like a particular food, and it just like, oh man, that reminds me of. The Bible does that with geography. I know, isn't that romantic? But particular places hold particular special meanings to God in the Bible story. For example, Mount Moriah. Link up some things with Mount Moriah for us. Okay, so Abraham goes and sacrifices his son Isaac on a mountain that God will show him, and it's a mountain in the land of Moriah. Okay? What else happens on Mount Moriah? Two other major events.
Mount Sinai.
I'm sorry?
Mount Sinai.
No, not Mount Sinai. It's Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah. I know it could have been another name.
Change names throughout time.
I know. Mount Moriah. The temple is built on Mount Moriah. There's another thing that happens on Mount Moriah. David offers a sacrifice there because he has taken a census of the people. It angers God. God sends pestilence on the people. There's the angel with the sword, and he goes to offer sacrifice. And is it Ornan, the Jebusite there, who's like, well, just take my animals and sacrifice. And David says, I cannot offer to the Lord that which costs me nothing. That happens there at Mount Moriah. So those three things get linked up in this one particular location. Yeah? So when God thinks of Mount Moriah, there's a sentiment there. And if you're a thoughtful Bible student, you'll go, oh, Moriah. Oh, wow. That's when, and you'll be thinking, God spared Isaac. And then you'll be thinking, God spared the people. And then you'll be thinking, temple worship and sacrifice. And then you'll be thinking, just outside Jerusalem is where Jesus was killed, and all those things link up. Okay, here's another one, for example. Look at Hosea 9. I'm trying to get us excited about geography, because if you're me, it's like, ah, geography, okay. But look at Hosea 9. Here God is explaining his reasons for sending the people into captivity. Okay, this is Israel in the north, and he wants them to get why he's so upset with him. In Hosea 9, verse 15, every evil of theirs is in Gilgal. There I began to hate them. Now that's God saying that about Israel. Hosea 9, verse 15. Every evil of theirs is in Gilgal. He began to hate them in Gilgal. Well, if you're just reading that and going, all right, yep, check, read my daily Bible reading, you're not going to be inclined to go, wait, Gilgal, what's... Break out a concordance and look up where does Gilgal happen, what's going on in Gilgal, and what are some stories that happened in Gilgal? Amos?
It's when the people first crossed over the Jordan River and had their first meal.
Excellent. So they come into Gilgal, which I don't think is on this map. It will be in a moment because I marked it. But they come into the land of Canaan for the first time in Gilgal. They remember the Passover, right? For the first time in the land, God stops the manna from coming, and they circumcise all the men. God rolls away all of the shame from Egypt. That happens at Gilgal. And it's just outside Gilgal, Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, where they take on the blessings and the curses, and that's confirmed there. Not right at Gilgal, but it's near Gilgal. But remember, one of the things they did at Gilgal is they lay up stones. Where did they get the stones?
From the Jordan River.
From the Jordan River. 12 stones, commemorating when God led them across on dry ground. All right, so Gilgal. Is that a good thing or a bad thing so far?
Good.
It's a really good thing. Then why does it say that God began to hate them there? Because there are other things that happen at Gilgal. And if you keep on walking through the Bible narrative, you get to stories like 1 Samuel 15. Where in 1 Samuel 15, God sends somebody to go and kill somebody. Do you remember?
Saul.
Sends Saul to go and destroy all of the Amalekites, or Amalekites. I don't know how you pronounce it, but destroy all the Amalekites. All those people. And did he do it?
No.
Didn't do it. Spared Agag, spared the best of the herds and the flocks and all the livestock. And Samuel hears about it from the Lord. Samuel spends the whole night weeping and crying. God says, I've regretted that I've made Saul king over my people. Samuel stepped aside so this man could become king. And here King Saul comes, and he sets up a monument to himself at Carmel. A monument not to the Lord, but to himself. Aren't I great? And then he marches on down into Gilgal with this herd of animals, and King Agag being led in procession, and it's at Gilgal where God confronts him through Samuel. And there's this whole thing going on. Sentiment. Nostalgia. God builds those sorts of things into the story. Now, there's some other things that happen at Gilgal. We won't take the time to look at it, but I want you to begin to appreciate, if you see a name or a location, store that away somewhere. Because it's like, oh, that sounds familiar. Take the time to look up in a concordance, oh, this is where that thing happened. Because we do that even in our history, right? We do that for dates. 9/11, right? That means something to some people. We're getting to an age where that doesn't mean as much. July 4th, right? Boston Massacre. Okay, there's certain things that just, they mean something to certain people. And if you're paying attention to history, you'll go, oh, wow, Kiriath Arba. Wait a minute. What happened to Kiriath Arba? I'll let you look it up sometime and figure that out. But there's sentiment involved here. This is part of the story. And God's building themes and messages. And there are all these connections. Okay? We get upset, I get upset, when people don't know what 9/11 is because they were born afterward. God's working with people over thousands of years. And so he's got story built up in these locations, and you got a new generation that comes along that doesn't know the Lord, doesn't know the story, and he's like, you're kidding me. Gilgal, okay? Look at Gilgal. So geography helps to further the story. Now, questions, thoughts, comments? All right, we'll keep trucking then. So in Joshua 13, he establishes these three tribes, or rather two and a half tribes, east of the Jordan. One place I want you to notice, in verse 9, from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, which you can see here on the east side of the Dead Sea, the Arnon River. So that's going to be the southern boundary of Reuben. But you see just here, east of Mount Nebo, you've got Medeba. There's the modern-day city of Medeba, which is the same city. And they get excited about geography, too. This is the Medeba Mosaic. They made this mosaic back in the Byzantine? I can't pronounce these words. And then they tiled over it. Can you believe that? They tile over it. It's like you go into an old house and they put plank linoleum over hardwood. It's like, what are you doing? This is even worse. They tiled over this mosaic, and this is a mosaic of the Holy Land. Okay, that big blue body of water up there, that is the Dead Sea. So the Dead Sea is over here to the right. The Jordan River is flowing into the sea. There's an antelope up on top. I think it's a lion over there. Is this the... Aha! Yes, here it is. I can't say the letters. What are these letters here? Do you know these letters?
Eroso.
What's the word? What city is that? It's Jericho. This is the city of Jericho being put here in the mosaic. And so they had these maps. Here is Jerusalem itself. And they notice, and if you could take the time, you can look this up on Google anytime. But they have the different gates all set up here. So it's a map, and they have it facing east at the top. So we kind of go, that's weird. But the river's running, you know, north to south, but left to right. And so they've got Jerusalem here, and you can look up
They have all the gates situated. So just exciting to think about how they were concerned with these places because it's part of the Bible story. And so it's the largest mosaic map in the world. So anyway, I got to see that last fall about this time. So looking at the tribes to the east side of the Jordan, you've got Reuben, Gad, half a tribe of Manasseh. Now, there's one little thing here on this map, actually a few that I'm not sure about. For example, if you look at look at Gad. So you've got Reuben in verses 15 through 23. And then look at verse 24. Moses gave an inheritance also to the tribe of Gad, to the people of Gad, according to their clans. Their territory was Jazer and all the cities of Gilead and half the land of the Ammonites. Anytime you see Gilead, like a city, Gilead, like Ramoth Gilead, okay, it'll be referring to something on the east side of the Jordan River. This is the land of Gilead, okay, it's the pasture lands, which is why the tribes wanted to stay over there anyway. They wanted to stay there because they had lots of livestock. In verse 25, half the land of the Ammonites to Aroer, which is east of Rabbah. So their boundary is going to be east of Rabbah. Do you notice a problem here with the map then? Yeah, here's Rabbah, modern day Ammon, and they didn't pop it out here. I'm not sure why they didn't put, maybe they know something, I don't know, but it seems like in Joshua, the boundary should have gone even further past Rabbah. I don't know why they did it that way. So when you find a map of Bible lands, don't always trust it, okay? Because sometimes we're putting places where we think these cities might have been, but we're not quite sure. We know where Jericho is. We know where Jerusalem is. We know where Hebron is. We know where a lot of these places are. But sometimes we're dropping pins saying, I think it's here. Not quite sure. We know where Rabbah is because of modern-day Ammon, right? Ammon of Jordan. So it would have jutted out here. All this is important. But at the end of chapter 13, we come to the tribe of Levi. And in 13:32, the inheritance that Moses distributed in the plains of Moab, this is that inheritance, beyond the Jordan, east of Jericho. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance. The Lord God of Israel is their inheritance, just as he said to them. So where's Levi going to end up?
Sprinkled throughout all the other tribes.
They're going to be spread throughout the tribes. And what's the reason given why they don't get their own territory?
The Lord's their inheritance.
The Lord's their inheritance. Okay, but what are they going to eat?
Tithes?
The tithe. They're going to get the tithe. They're going to get, what are they going to eat? They're going to get the tenth contribution from the rest of the nation. And then from that tenth, they themselves will tithe a tenth to the priesthood. So the Levites are not going to be listed in these tribal territories. They are a tribe, but they're not going to be listed in the tribal territories. Which brings up a question. How many tribes are there?
There's still 12 because it's
Levi. Manasseh gets split, so we'll count East Manasseh and West Manasseh as Manasseh. Elijah?
There are 12 because Joseph had two sons, and he's not counted as a tribe, but his two sons are.
Well, you just made 13, then.
You don't count Levi.
But right, so here's what's happened. Levi is a tribe, but it's not counted as one of the 12 tribes, because when we're talking about the 12 tribes, we're talking about the territories. Okay, their inheritance is the land. Levi, they get the Lord as the inheritance. That's a very special thing. But what happens, remember, Jacob goes to bless Joseph's sons, and he blesses Ephraim with his right hand and Manasseh with his left hand, and Joseph's like, whoa, what are you doing? Because he's seen this sort of problem before. Remember, the older shall serve the younger, Jacob, Esau. And Jacob, I know God's going to bless Manasseh too, but he's going to make Ephraim great. And Ephraim does become great in a very special way, but he blesses these two. He does that because these are Joseph's sons. He says, I'm taking your two sons as my sons. What does that do for Joseph? It makes Joseph the one to get the double portion. Joseph becomes the one with the firstborn rights. Okay, these are like, what, remember Jacob and Esau? Esau's been out in the field, he comes in, he's hungry, and Jacob's over there stirring up the lentil soup, and you know, he's like, man, that smells so good. Give me your birthright. It's the double portion.
So if you divide up your property amongst your children, you get two kids. We divide it in three, and the oldest one would get the double portion. Joseph gets the double, don't smile. Joseph gets the double portion. So that makes sense of Ephraim and Manasseh. They're very large people, okay? But Levi's going to be treated specially. So it's not a trick question, but it's how many tribes of Israel are there? 12. But depending on how you're asking, you need to remember that Levi's there to Joseph. That comes back up later in the book of Revelation. And so some of these things, again, it's that nostalgia thing. You read the Revelation and it mentions the tribes. And then you start paying attention. It's like, well, those are funny ways to list the tribes. That's not the way I'm familiar with them in the Old Testament. Take your time, work it out, and there's a lesson there. Right? Explain the number of tribes. I already did that. Number four. Question number four in your study guide.
Yeah.
I love Caleb. What's up with Caleb? Who is Caleb?
He's one of the
spies. Okay, so he's one of the spies who went into the land. There were 12 spies originally.
Right. One of the Jews that said, yeah, we can do it.
Okay, so Caleb and Joshua are the two who come back and say, yes, there are giants, but God's with us, let's go. And so here you get these two grizzled, I mean, they are the last holdouts from the previous generation. And Caleb comes up and... How do you picture Caleb here? Yeah, so Jordan's like, he comes up, you know, comes up to Joshua with a cane. How does Caleb describe himself, though?
He's as strong now as he was then.
Strength becoming.
So maybe he comes with a staff, right? He comes up and he's, you know, he's got some gusto, okay? I do kind of picture him a little more, I mean, he's 85 years old. Now, that tells you something, doesn't it? It's been a few years, okay? It's been a few years since they first come into the land. You start piecing this together, this is not like 2 months after they come into the land. It's been a few years. They've been working on taking the territory for a while. Little by little, God has driven out some of the Canaanites. So here comes Caleb, and these 45 years now, verse 10 of chapter 14, the Lord has kept me alive. The Lord spoke this word to Moses. Israel walked in the wilderness. Now, behold, I am this day 85. I'm still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then for war and for going and coming. What does Caleb want?
Give me some place I can go take out.
But you point me to the battle, buddy. I don't know. I like to think that Joshua and Caleb were just like, you know, like this. They had an understanding, an appreciation for each other. They had seen things that nobody else there had seen. And so he comes to Joshua and he says, Joshua, this is what I've been waiting for. You and me, we were out there for 40 years and we didn't have to be, but we were there because of the people's rebellion. We've got a new generation of people who are going to follow. Let's go. You show me where the fight is. And so he takes the hill country of Judah. Now, hill country, I'll show you a cross-section of the land in just a moment. But he's going to take the hill country. Let's see, I've got Gad, Manasseh, come down here into Judah. He's going to take the hill country of Judah. And particularly, he's going to focus on what area? Let's read into chapter 15 to get this one.
Is it where there were giants?
He wants to go where the giants are. In chapter 14, verse 12, give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be if the Lord will be with me, I shall drive them out just as the Lord had said. So he wants to go where the giants are. And he wants to go in particular to chapter 15, verse 13. Goes to Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. Now, Arba was the father of the Anak. That'd be the Anakim. You've got the Anakim, the Rephaim, these are the giants. And so this is like the stronghold of the giants. And Caleb, who's 85, says, you show me where that stronghold is, let's go. But he also says, whoever will take that stronghold and capture it, and this is Kiriath Sefer in verse 16, there's another stronghold, captures that one, I'll give my daughter his wife. And so he's kind of upping the ante here for anybody else who's going to step in and be courageous like he is. And who takes him up on the offer? his nephew, Othniel. Now, who is Othniel? And don't say Caleb's nephew. Lyndon? He's the first judge.
So, the book of Joshua, the book of Judges, we may think, oh, consecutively this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. We have to appreciate that there's a lot of overlap happening between Joshua and Judges, and even amongst the judges, there's going to be a lot of overlap. So chronologically, it's not this one, and then this one, and then this one, and then this one, and then this one. This is Othniel, who's going to be the first judge in the book of Judges. And so he goes up, and he says, I'll take the land. And he goes, and he defeats it, and then Caleb gives Othniel, his nephew, his daughter, as his wife. Caleb's daughter is Othniel's wife. And then she asks for a portion of land in the Negev. Give me also springs of water. Now, where's the Negev? Yeah, Negev essentially just means south, right? And so it's in this southern portion of the land. You're also going to see language like the Arba. Modern times, we refer to the Arba, we're referring to down south as well. But traditionally, in ancient times, you're looking at from the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan Rift Valley, all the way down through. But she's in the Negev, and she says, give me springs of water. The Negev is desert. So she's got land, great. But what does she need in the desert? It's water. And so she asks for the springs of water, too. Now, I love Caleb. What do you see in Caleb that you think, I need to do more of that? What do you learn from Caleb?
Proactivity.
What do you mean?
He's not waiting on everyone else to be ready to serve God. He's just willing to get up and do it.
Yes. Yeah. And he's not waiting for the younger guys to step in and do it. He's just he's going to go in and he's going to take it. He's not waiting for Joshua to tell him, here's your land. He's like, let me take it. Let's go. Assertive. Taking initiative. Being proactive. Some things we could do there spiritually, right? So-and-so needs a phone call. So-and-so needs a note of encouragement. So-and-so needs to spend time with other Christians. I'm going to invite them over for dinner. So-and-so needs some counseling here. So-and-so, or I need some counseling. And so you're going to be active and take initiative. That's Caleb.
Maybe Faith, he's been waiting a long time for this to happen.
We're studying Genesis on Thursday mornings, and it's just been interesting to me. God often asks his people to wait. Abraham waited. 75 when he goes to the land of promise. He's how old when he has a son? When he has Isaac? He's 100 years old. Isaac, he gets married at 40. He's 60 before he has a son. God asks his people to wait. And so here's Caleb, and he's got to trust God. God's going to get me there. He didn't spare me in the wilderness for nothing. I've got to wait. I've got to be patient. God keeps his promises. What else do you see in Caleb?
Does he follow the Lord fully?
Yeah, I love that. What verse is that?
14.
Yeah. My brothers, in verse 8, who went up with me, made the heart of the people melt. When we get discouraged, which is going to happen sometimes, if we act on that discouragement, act on that faithlessness, it spreads. But then you see, Caleb, I wholly follow the Lord my God. There's got to be somebody who's going to stand up and say, no, we're going to do what's right. We're going to follow the Lord. This looks bad, but I know God's going to see us through. It's Caleb. Wow. Do you have a hand up? Go ahead.
I'm just thinking about what you just touched on, the idea that he was willing to stand alone in his conviction of what was right for a really long time.
Yes.
I mean, it was hard initially to be one of the two, only the two spies that were saying, no, God can do this, and have that belief and faith. But then all the people around them are not. And so to be able to remain firm in your conviction when everyone around you is behaving unfaithfully, and then continue that while you wait 40 years for that entire generation to die off, and even coming into the land. So just to see how he was willing to be different for a long time.
Yeah. That shows up in a lot of different areas. Thinking about going to college, or whether you go to college or not, or getting married, and whether you want to get married or not, and your friends are going off, and their lives are continuing, you go, well, what about me? And you're going to stick to your principles. Or people get advancements in their careers, and what are you going to do? Stick to God-given principles. And it seems like life is passing you by. Caleb is 85 years old, and he gets to go and fight. Sometimes he's got to wait. But you wait on the Lord, right? There's a different spirit about Caleb, and we need Caleb today. Other thoughts about Caleb? Bruce?
Why would Caleb do something like this? Is this some sort of test? Like giving the reward of his daughter as a wife for anyone who would take the stronghold?
Maybe it's just an honor. Maybe it's time to marry his daughter off, and he's like, who am I going to choose? I'm going to choose the biggest, baddest guy around. But Othniel steps up and takes it. I mean, if I had to choose who to marry my daughter off to, it'd be like, all right, let's see. To devise some test, okay? Don't worry. Okay. Now, in 15, Judah gets his allotment. And they all come back to Gilgal. So where is Gilgal? Generally speaking, Gilgal is not so much a city as it is a location, as a place. Remember, they cross over opposite Jericho. And it's there at Gilgal they set up all of the stones. So it's at Gilgal that the people come back and gather. Now, what is Jericho at this point? Smoked rubble. It's just gone. It's a crater. Okay? So they come back to Gilgal, and there's peace. Notice what it says in 14, verse 15. The land had rest from war. That's repeated from chapter 11, verse 23. The land had rest from war. When they're doing what God wants them to do, even though there's still battles to be had, the land has rest. So there's periods of time where things are difficult, they got to fight, and then they can have rest because they're doing what God wants them to do. What's that song? Peace, perfect peace. To do the will of Jesus, this is rest. So they're doing the will of God and they're getting rest from it. Now, Judah's going to get its allotment, but Caleb wants Hebron, and so Hebron's all his. Takes that one. We can spend some more time just for sake of time. I want to come and look at this one here. Okay. This is a cross section of Israel. So we are on the east side of the Jordan River. North is on the right, south is on the left. The measurement of the hilltops isn't quite to scale because Jerusalem, made a note of this, Jerusalem is about 2,500 feet, still pretty high. Mount Hermon is a little over 9,000 feet, so not quite to scale. Mount Hermon's all the way in the north. It's in what today is called the Golan Heights, and it's disputed territory between Israel and Syria, as is so much of this. But they have a ski resort there on Mount Hermon. Okay, it's snow-covered peak. But look how deep things are. So you've got 2,500 feet there, Jerusalem, and the Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level. That's a huge change in elevation. So you've got Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, and these are the two mountain peaks where they pronounce the blessings and the curses to each other. Blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience. Bethlehem is on a mountain. Hebron is the hill country. So when you think about the hill country of Judah, don't think like gentle rolling Kentucky hills. These are rocky crags. This is wilderness. You can get lost here. And so this is a place where there are strongholds, and you would want to own this territory so that you can build your strongholds here. But you think about the cross section, it is, I saw a YouTube video this last week of a guy, they have models, and he was taking his camera through, make you sick if you're careful. But there are lots of resources online where you can check out the geography. Looking at a flat map is like, oh, okay. But look at the cross section of the place, and it's a strangely different territory. So now we're looking north, up the Jordan Valley. So there,
there's the coastal plain, which is where the Philistines are going to be left. The Philistines are going to stay there in the coastal plain. The foothills of the Judean hillside country, the Shephelah. And then you've got the Judean hills, the Jordan Rift Valley, and then you've got the Transjordan Plateau. So you've got all the mountains on the eastern side. Mount Nebo and Mount Zion are about eye level with each other. Now, if you're on Mount Nebo looking down to Jerusalem, it still looks like you're looking down just because of the earth's round. But there's this huge change in elevation. So as you're thinking about the people passing through, this comes into play, as we'll see through the rest of the Bible story, this comes into play when they're taking different battles. For example, when David and Goliath are going to battle, and the Israelites and the Philistines are there in the Valley of Elah. Why is the Valley of Elah the place for a battle? If you're in a territory where there are lots of hills and mountainous crags, you want control of the best ways to get through that territory. And the Valley of Elah was one of those locations. So in order to capture that territory, they had a battle over that. And of course, David wins that.